We have with us and have had with us for this week on campus Dr. Alvaro Carino, who was our Synod's pioneer missionary in the Philippines. He's a 1937 graduate of Concordia Seminary here. He first became acquainted with Christianity and the seminary by means of KFUO's radio broadcasts, and attended school at Concordia, Missouri, St. Paul's College there, and then attended here. He went back to St. Paul, or back to Concordia, Missouri, for his vicarage, because Dean Fritz thought he should become acquainted with the activities of a large, active congregation. He has been a city missionary in Chicago after graduation, awaiting the time when he could return to the Philippines to do mission work there. And following the war, he spent some 28 years. Then was one of the founders of the Lutheran Church in the Philippines and the first president of that body, and is now retired to full-time work with the Lay Apostolate Training Program and the Human Development Retreat Center in the northern part of the Philippines. This evening, he would like to share with us, by means of some slides, a little bit of the history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and its work in the Philippines. So without any other comments on my part, let's welcome Dr. Carino.
Fellow workers, it's a pleasure of ours to come and visit with you at this time. I had hoped that somehow we would have a warm weather in St. Louis. Somehow, since we arrived early in December, this cold climate that you have in the United States seemingly had followed us all over, from the Twin Cities down to Orlando, Florida, where they even had freezing point there in Orlando. Now here in St. Louis, this morning when I was trying to walk to the seminary, I simply could not go on in progress without sliding back and falling on my face. By way of introduction, I should like to update you on the story of your church in the Philippines. The Lutheran Church in the Philippines did not begin with much fanfare as our church in Japan or New Guinea had started. As a matter of fact, when your first missionaries to the Philippines were sent out there, there was not much excitement in our church here in America. Possibly one reason was that your boys were just coming home after the war. Consequently, when the missionaries were sent, the welcome mat for the boys who came home had eclipsed the excitement over the beginning of your mission work abroad, because actually much of the mission work of the Missouri Synod had started soon after the Second World War. Then all of a sudden, a lot of excitement began to take place, especially when the Japanese Mikado resigned his divinity, as it were, and General MacArthur had encouraged the different church groups in America to go to Japan. And there were talks in those days of a takeover of the Japanese by Christianity. And then after that, another excitement began to happen. Our missionaries in China had to evacuate. They had to return to the United States. Meantime, exciting news were heard about our church in New Guinea, when hundreds, yea, thousands had been baptized in the different villages where our missionaries there had worked. And so the Philippines were not very much known in those days as a field for missions. And even today, as I travel around, there are more people who seem to know more about individuals who had worked there than the work of the church in the Philippines. A few years ago, I gave a sort of a lecture in one of the New England states, and after giving a rather long, informative lecture on our church there, a distinguished-looking man came to me after a while and said, "How is our friend Fidel Castro getting along?" Which seems to indicate that even the geography of the Philippines is not pretty well known. And so it's an opportunity for me to inform you that we have a young Lutheran church down under the other side of the world that is trying to carry out the mission of the church in your name, in the name of all people of God here in the United States who had been praying and supporting the work for missions, that our church in the Philippines is indeed a growing, witnessing church. Despite the fact that the young church is not too well known here in the United States, let me inform you that according to the reports of the Board for Missions, the Lutheran Church in the Philippines had enjoyed wonderful growth. As a matter of fact, it is supposed to be the fastest growing Lutheran church in Asia today. And so your church in the Philippines had been blessed by God in terms of fruits of the labors of the missionaries whom you had sent there. The Lutheran Church in the Philippines has about 12,000 members, about 3,500 communicants. We have over 100 congregations and outstations served by 18 missionaries from the United States at the present time, and some 22 national pastors. Unfortunately, we have always been short of manpower. We could have expanded into many regions of the 7,000 islands that compose this young insular republic, but we haven't enjoyed the number of missionaries we have requested. As a matter of fact, we had to wait sometimes for some years before we could get new workers there. Now, our little church in the Philippines, as I said before, is a witnessing church. It tries to reach out to as many places as it could in the beginning, and even at the present time. As you know, we have over 7,000 islands inhabited by 43 million people. And you can see at once that we have a potential for growth among so many people. And the door is wide open. There are no restrictions whatsoever as far as doing mission work is concerned, as far as winning the people to Christianity is concerned. As a matter of fact, many missionary observers are saying that the Republic of the Philippines is the most fertile ground for mission work throughout Asia today. And so we have great opportunities there. Our young church witnesses to the many millions who do not yet know Christ as Savior, but it also witnesses to the existing churches and denominations that are represented there today. We even have a wonderful opportunity to do our witness among the 38-some million members of the Roman Catholic Church. And the initiative of the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, dialogues got started between us and the Roman Catholic hierarchy. And when they discovered that our doctrine and baptism is essentially their doctrine, they said, well, why don't we have a baptismal agreement? And so it did happen that our Lutheran church in the Philippines is possibly the only Protestant church, at least in Asia, that has a baptismal agreement with the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic hierarchy is very friendly to us. As president of the Lutheran Church in the Philippines, some years ago, I had been invited by the hierarchy to be an observer at the Roman Catholic Bishops' Conference in Asia, which included representatives from Sri Lanka and India, all nations, countries in the Pacific and Asia. And one day during one of those discussions in which we talk about our witness in Asia, because in Asia we have more than half of the population of the globe today, and hardly 2% of the people of Asia are committed to Christianity. And somehow the bishops were so enthused about witness in Asia, but at the same time felt frustrated because of the lack of workers and also of the prejudices that Asian people have against Christianity. And one of the cardinals said to me, and in the presence of many others among the bishops, you and I, he said, are in this together. Meaning to say that the Roman Catholic Christians and we in the Lutheran Church are in this together, in bringing our Christian witness to the 2.5 billion people of Asia. Incidentally, I had occasion to shake hands with the Pope. I did not kiss his ring, of course, when I met him at the airport. President of the Philippines was escorting him, was walking side by side. When it came my turn to be introduced to him, and I said to him, in the name of the Lutheran Church in the Philippines, Your Holiness, I welcome you. And the Pope showed a lot of interest in the term Lutheran. He smiled, he grinned, he took my hands to shake hands with me, then he placed the other hand on mine, and I placed mine on his, and we began to shake hands, just like that. And then he asked, in his customary Italian accent, "Do you have Lutheran churches in Manila too?" And meantime, the president of the Philippines was somewhat amused. And in this way, the term Lutheran is quite highly respected now among the Roman Catholic hierarchy. I had been asked a number of times to speak to the students in their seminary. Now that's unnaturally not a common practice among them. But they're very friendly to us. And they even requested us to make use of their facilities, particularly broadcasting stations. And so for a time, Radio Veritas in Manila, which is a Vatican-supported radio station that broadcasts its messages in Asia, see, had been used by the Lutheran Hour to broadcast our programs. So our witness to the other church bodies in the Philippines, it had been freely shared, not only with the Roman Catholics, but even with the mainline denominational groups that are, or they had, that had been working in the Philippines for more than half a century. And so when our young church that had been invited to become an associate member of the National Council of Churches joined, believe it or not, they appreciated that we had a witness to bring to them, to the churches, and one of those big churches is a Roman Catholic group, or rather a Catholic group that had seceded from the Roman Catholic Church. We call this the Aglipayan Church or the Philippine Independent Church, with a membership of 3 million. At any rate, they elected the president of the Lutheran Church in the Philippines, first as a vice chairman, and the following term he was elected as chairman of the council. Now this was a form of witness to fellow Christians, to be sure. There was no objectionable kind of practice which would be objected to, of course, by our sister churches. As a matter of fact, this had been referred to our leaders in the United States, and they appreciated the opportunity of that young church to do its witness. No, there had been no practice of unionism, not at all. The executive secretary of this council of 5 million members said the Lutheran Church has much contribution to give us, especially strong in its theology. We need the Lutheran Church to strengthen the churches in theology. A recognition of the contribution that our church can make. So we are, in a sense, fortunate that in the Philippines our young church is doing the witness that you expect it to do among so many millions of people there, and not only among the so-called uncommitted, but also to those who are presumed to be members of the Christian church but need re-strengthening, need certainly the witness that we have. Now, I should like to share with you certain insights in mission work as we have been doing in the Philippines in the light of the pictures that will be flashed to you this evening. Could you turn off the lights, please? In olden days, missionaries made use of slide lanterns, and it's now quite different today. Now, those of you who lived during the turn of the century can see at once how different our people were, say, in 1900. They still wore those hats in those days. The Philippines, locationally, in the relative position to the world, that white spot there is where we see the Philippines. You can see at once that they are in the Pacific. They're close to the main land of Asia. They are really on the gateway to Asia. And the United States and the other side of the world, if this were a globe, for instance, we are practically below, down there on the other side of the world. It is daytime in the Philippines now, while we are now facing the night in the side of the world. As far as climatic conditions are concerned, we belong in what we call a tropical country, or a place where most of the people in the world live. See? There are lots of lands in Asia today that are much like the Philippines. Since we belong to what we call the monsoonal region of Asia, the Philippines enjoy much the same climate and culture that you find in that region of the world. We have what we call the Pacific Basin. The Pacific Basin is where most of the islands in the world are located. Now, there are islands, to be sure, north of the tundras of Siberia there. There are not too many, but most of the archipelagos are located in the Pacific. And so you have island groups such as the Hawaiian group, the Marianas, the Marshalls, the Solomons, Indonesia, the Philippines, and so on. So there are tens of thousands of islands and atolls in the Pacific. And the Philippines, of course, are located there in the eastern, or rather western Pacific, close to Asia. And here you find many people who are still primitive in their ways, as we will see in the following pictures. In olden days, we used to cross the ocean by ships. Usually took about 18 to 21 days to reach the Philippines from San Francisco. But the changes that have taken place in the last few years are phenomenal. Today, we take a jet from, say, San Francisco and get to Manila in a matter of 13 some hours. You can see at once the difference. When the Concorde will begin to fly from San Francisco during the next few years, you may have your breakfast in Los Angeles or San Francisco and have your lunch in Manila. It'll be just a matter of 5 hours or so. So the world is shrinking, and the missionaries are certainly enjoying the changes that are taking place in the world today. Now, when we cross the Pacific, we may visit one of the United States, the 51st state of the United States, that's Hawaii. The aloha welcome certainly makes you feel at home there. This group of islands, very precious to America, no doubt. Here you have some of your bases. Your mid-Pacific base is located in Pearl Harbor and other islands in the territory. And that may be one of your last line of defense if you lose out, say, in the mid-Pacific. At any rate, Pastor Meyer had been a pastor in Hawaii. And he knows the strategic advantages of owning this group of islands in mid-Pacific. Honolulu is located in this island of Oahu. And incidentally, we have about 45,000 Filipinos living in this island. They had been brought here many years ago, as far back as 1915, as laborers. The sugar planters and owners of pineapple plantations did not find the Japanese or Chinese adapted to this kind of work. But since the Filipinos became subjects of the United States, they tried. Filipinos are workers in the Hawaiian plantations. And lo and behold, they were just the ones that the American owners of those plantations wanted to work there. And so today in this island, Oahu, there are 45,000 Filipinos. And throughout the Hawaiian group, state of Hawaii, there are close to about 100,000 Filipinos who came from the Philippines. And so in this place, we naturally have opportunities also to do our witness among these folks. The ethnic group that had inhabited Hawaii since the beginning of its history were the so-called Polynesians. They had a king by the name King Kamehameha. But this race is dying out. And certainly the Hawaiians are quite concerned that the Polynesians are disappearing even in the Hawaiian group. But otherwise, they used to be big people, quite tall and heavy. And they say that they are also related to the people who live close to New Zealand and out there in Pango Pango and so on. But the race is disappearing. Today, the people of this state is really a combination of many different ethnic groups. You find there Caucasians, of course, and Japanese, Chinese, Malays, Filipinos, and even some from the Caribbean. So if you go to Hawaii, this is a unique state. Naturally, it has the opportunity of becoming a tourist center in mid-Pacific. About 1 million tourists visit Hawaii every year, or at least pass through Honolulu every year. The favorite water sport is that surfing or skiing. Now, as in most of the islands in the Pacific, the palm tree is quite a familiar sight anywhere. And so in Hawaii, we have a Philippine consulate in Honolulu. The consul there has the rank of minister. I made a survey of Honolulu a few years ago because there was an interest on the part of our congregations in Hawaii to start mission work among the Filipinos. So I went to the consulate and made inquiries, and this consular official encouraged us by all means to do work among the Filipinos in Hawaii so that we can be helpful also in having them adjusted to the culture to which they had not been used as immigrants. Now, here you see again the so-called Pacific Basin, and those spots on the map are American bases. Hawaii, way to the right in the middle, and even before that you find Wake Island, and then the middle circle there, the white spot in the map, is the group known as the Marianas, where you find Guam. And Guam is getting to be a major U.S. base in the Pacific. And way to the left is the Philippines. Here you also have your bases. As a matter of fact, your largest U.S. air base is located in the Philippines. And your U.S. Navy air base outside the United States, the largest, is located in the Philippines, in Subic. And so these are the three great main bases of America in the Pacific. However, your line of defense is now extending from the Aleutian Islands down to Japan, an enemy which you have made into an ally, and then down to Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia, which is developing also to become a friend of the American of the Americans. Now, in Guam, you find your a part of your Navy here and your Air Force, and here you brought to the United States through via Guam so many scores of thousands of refugees from South Vietnam. The island of Guam is only about 35 miles long, about four miles wide, very small, but it belongs to a group of islands known as the Marianas. And there are people who live in outside Guam who are not of the same ethnic group that inhabit this island of Guam today. Because again, this island of Guam is peopled by Filipinos. During the galleon trade, the Spaniards forced Filipinos to come and live in Guam in order to take care of the at least the ports there, and were made to forced to labor here in the interest of the Spaniards. During the galleon trade, then Filipinos were brought here. But after the Spanish-American War, the Americans had taken possession of the Marianas and Guam, and brought more Filipinos to work in Guam. Then after World War II, the island of Guam had to be rehabilitated, and so more Filipino laborers and contractors were brought to Guam. And so today, practically 1/7 of the people in the island of Guam alone are Filipinos. And again, it was an opportunity for us to do our witness on the island of Guam, but unfortunately we do not have the manpower to send either to Honolulu or to Hawaii and also to Guam. But here in the mid-Pacific, you find people who need to be brought to the knowledge of God in Christ. Now the Catholics in Guam, mostly Filipinos, built themselves a cathedral like this. Quite a beautiful structure, simple every way. Now Guam has the same kind of climate that we have in the Philippines. Similar vegetation maybe is growing in Guam, the bamboos there and the flame tree. This happens to be the state where the governor lives, who has a Filipino background. And so our Lutheran Church in the Philippines had been toying also with the idea of sending missionaries here, and also the idea of sending a Timothy worker in the state of Hawaii. Now, I said before that there are kinds of people who live in the Pacific who are still primitive. In the island of Yap, for instance, you may find structures like this, and incidentally, the round rock with the hole in the middle is supposed to be the medium of exchange. That's their money. Well, you can't put that in the pocketbook, to be sure. But they would use that as their medium of exchange. And here are some of the natives. Those are schoolgirls in Yap Island. We have a Kwesi group, Kwesi Lutheran group, that had sent missionaries to teach these people in Yap Island. I met this dedicated couple who had a Lutheran background doing mission work among these people. There are many more, tens of thousands of natives in the Pacific who need to be rich with the gospel. Now we now finally come to the Philippines. As in the case of Australia, Indonesia, the Philippines were once upon a time a part of Asia, they say. So you notice those light section of the map, those are supposed to be land bridges way down in the sea, in the bottom of the sea, but shallow enough, therefore, to indicate to the scientists to observe that these once upon a time were land bridges which connected Australia and these islands with the mainland of Asia. Now, when we study the people who live in these groups of islands, you will notice an ethnic group that is common to all these groups of islands, the Papuans and the Negritos in the Philippines and others who live in the heart of Sumatra. They're about the same kind of people, see, dark and with kinky hair, rather pygmy due to long centuries of life without the benefit of civilization. And so we find those people today. So some of the scientists are saying that they had been caught here when the land bridges finally had been were covered by water due to the catastrophe that had taken place in the past. Now, the Philippines belong to a region known as Southeast Asia, of course. In other words, they belong to this group here, South Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Laos, and so on. And the same kind of ethnic group living in this region. In other words, Malays. The Malays originally came from the foothills of the Himalayas, and so Malaya or Malay. So these, many centuries ago, according to the story, had spilled into the Pacific and inhabited many of the islands in the Pacific. They were supposedly the first sailors in Asia who had betaken themselves in boats and migrated all over the Pacific. Those are the Malays. You can see it once the location of the Philippines with lines extended from the center of this circle all the way to those thickly populated areas of Asia. They are about centered in the geography of Asia. We have, of course, landforms that are similar to many places in the United States as the Rockies. And we have water basins on the tops of these mountains which had been converted into hydroelectric powers. And so much of our electricity come from this hydroelectric power, the three of them which supply all the electric power that we need on the island of Luzon. And our industries, of course, enjoy cheap energy. Now, many of the people in the Philippines came originally from Indonesia, perhaps from Celebes and say Java, where they had what we call the terrace culture. The terrace rice culture indicates that among the Malays there had been a more or less a scientific kind of farming that had existed for many centuries. And so when these people came to the island of Luzon, they carved out farms along the sides of the hills. They have selected places where there is much rainfall, And so they have farms along the sides of the hills. And we have many, many, terraces in the Philippines today, rice terraces. When joined end to end, they can reach halfway around the world, they say. Which means that for many centuries, they have carved out farms on the sides of the hills. The erosion that would take place naturally fertilize a valley like this and can be very productive. That's for this reason that it's easy for anybody to live in a tropical insular country like the Philippines. It's so easy to plant anything and grow food for the families. Now we are building roads from the very lowest level of our island, sea level, so to say, up to 7,000 feet above sea level. Years ago, an engineer by the name Cannon planned a road from the lowland all the way up to a city called Baguio City. And this is the result of that. It's known as Cannon Road today. It is a first-class highway that winds along the sides of the mountains to the city of Baguio, where the American military forces have a sort of a rest camp. And so this is Camp John Hay. Many folks from Okinawa, from Guam, and all over Asia would come to Baguio City to rest. It's a matter of a few hours of flight from Guam, or certainly about an hour and a half from South Vietnam. Now this city called Baguio is located at an elevation of about 6,000 feet, and so the trees that grow here are of the long-needled pines. So you can see the American officers and men playing golf here in the city of Baguio in Camp John Hay. Here we also have work done in the city of Baguio, by the way. We have a number of churches in the Baguio area. Our missionaries had done work in the mountain places of Luzon among the so-called cultural minority groups. And so one of our missionaries work in, say, Tinglayan, and had established a small congregation here. Many of the folks who live in this part of the country are known as Igorots. Formerly they were headhunters. Today, in a village like this, where Pastor Becker had been stationed for a number of years, we have several hundred members. Members about church who had been baptized and taught and confirmed. They live in homes like this. It's quite cold here. 7,000 feet above sea level is quite high. And so the temperature is very pleasant. But the natives, not having enough blankets to cover themselves, would sleep on the second floor of their houses. There are no windows because the windows would only admit the cold air, and so that's it. That explains the lack of windows in their homes in the mountains. The Philippines is a land of colors, flowers all over, and it's so easy to plant any kind of flowering plant around your yard, and so bamboo orchids and dahlias can grow luxuriantly, and birds of paradise, gardenias, and so on. So cheap there. And fruits, of course, abound. Lots of bananas. Missionary and Mrs. Winters are here this evening. When they come to the Philippines 2 weeks from now, they'll be able to see so many bananas and all kinds of fruits in our market, especially along the countryside when you travel from, say, Baguio City down to the place where we live. And pineapples of the Hawaiian type grow luxuriantly anywhere in the Philippines. As a matter of fact, the Del Monte Company And Dole Pineapple Company have plantations on the plateau of Bukidnon today. And they now say that they can supply the whole world with all the pineapples it needs. And so in the island of Mindanao, very rich country. And the countryside is something like this. You find rice farms, and throughout the countryside you find good roads, first-class roads, concrete roads, and so on. We have all kinds of products, of course. Tobacco is one of them, and we even have grape plantations there now. Close to my hometown, this is a grape plantation in the island of Cebu. And other islands have grape plantations, which bring to the people a lot of income. Now, the coconut tree is always present in the Pacific, and certainly in the Philippines, we have many, many coconut groves. And it's one of our principal exports, by the way. Copra, it's a dried meat of coconut, is exported to Europe and also to the United States. Out of the copra, you make soap, you make oil margarine, you make perfume, and the oil you use for your high-precision machine. And to the people of the Philippines, of course, this is a precious tree, because the trunk of the tree can be used for building purposes. They can sow the log, coconut log, when it is very mature, and make use them as posts or girders in their houses. This tree like this is as many as 70 years old, and the height close to 70 feet. And the natives, of course, climb up to them and bring down the trees. Now, culture, our Philippine culture is really a multicultural, has a multicultural descriptive history. Now, way back in the beginning, we have the Malays, of course, who had introduced whatever kind of culture that they had in the past. But later on, our invaders of the Philippines, also introduced theirs. And the Spaniards contributed largely their religion. The Roman Catholicism of the Spanish tradition. And the Spaniards managed to put up churches, cathedral-like churches, in every community that they built. And so you can see this in towns like Vigan, or next to ours, besides the beautiful Catholic church in our town, close by is the Santa Lucia Church. Santa Lucia is a town of about 16,000 inhabitants today, but managed to keep Protestants out of the community because they had the idea that their patron saints, Santa Lucia, would be offended if they permitted other religions to enter their town, particularly Protestants. But one day, my wife and I met the owner of a high school, secondary school, call it an academy, about 1,000 students. And the principal of this high school was a Roman Catholic priest. But the owner of the school, having received his education in the United States, in the University of Nevada, became friendly to us, and he often asked us to conduct meetings in their school, especially at their convocations. You can just imagine 1,000 school students listening, and they seemed to like our messages. And so one day the owner of the academy said, "Why don't you begin mission work here in our town? I'll give you a piece of land on which to build a church." And we took advantage of that, and pretty soon the students attended my classes, and even the mayor of the town came to attend my meetings from time to time, especially on Thursday evenings. See? But the people began to scratch their head. Now, how come? See, did we not have a tradition? Do we not have a tradition that no other church be built in town? that Santa Lucia would be offended if another church be built here, especially when it is Protestant. Well, they went to the Catholic priest, who was the principal of the school, and asked him, why? Well, you know what the Roman Catholic priest said? He said, that is not a Protestant. It is Catholic, but it is called Lutheran Catholic. But ours is Roman Catholic, and that did it. So we had two churches here in Santa Lucia. The first time that Santa Lucia had a different a church built there. Well, that's just a story to be told, to be sure. And yet that's the way work can open up. See? Good public relations, having acquaintances, and pretty soon they practically take you by the hand and say, come on and talk to us and preach to us. Now the natives of the Philippines are largely Malays by origin. So this is typical Malay girl in the Philippines. However, many ethnic groups had since settled in the area, in our Philippine islands, and intermarried with the natives. See, we have Chinese mestizos, mestizas, and so on, and European folks who had come to live in the Philippines, such as the Spaniards, Portuguese, and many others from Europe. And so we have native something like this. See, she has a Spanish blood in her. She was one of our workers in our office in Manila, member of our church, or Philippine American, and many other groups of many other folks who come from a different ethnic group. Now we have all kinds of customs, of course. This one might amuse you. At a wedding like this, there is what they call a tradition called tupak. That is to say, a contest that would exist in the festivities at a wedding, where the relatives of the bride would pin peso notes on her wedding skirt, or the relatives of the groom would pin their gifts on the shirt of the bridegroom. And so you find peso bills pinned on the back of this young man. And after each dance of the bride and groom, the relatives would then pin their gifts on their wedding garments, you see. And after the contest, they would count the money. And they say that the winning side is presumed to think more of the marriage than the losing side. The object is to raise funds for the bride and groom to begin with. So there may be as many as 500 pesos, so the equivalent today, or in olden days, $250. See? And that's quite a gift for a young couple like this. That's just one of the customs that we have. And of course, in their festivities, they have all kinds of goodies for the people who come to attend their weddings, and the so-called lechon, an ever-present delicacy at such occasions. Now, the church in the Philippines had been planted there soon after World War II. The first mission of the Missouri Synod after the war. And as I started to say, it did not begin with much fanfare, had been forgotten. Nonetheless, our missionaries tried to follow the pattern that Dr. Smith and your speaker had planned when they surveyed the field in 1940. And so we have churches today in the main islands, particularly the island of Luzon, the island of Mindanao. And we set up missionary centers in the larger communities such as Davao, Iligan City, Butuan, and so on downline, Cebu City, and also on the island of Luzon. And from these missionary centers, our work expanded to reach out to other communities. That's our plan of our strategy in reaching out to as many of the people of the Philippines as possible. We even started work among the Muslims in Mindanao. Otherwise, we do not want to pocket our work in small rural communities where the expansion may be rather limited and even slow. Dr. Orit Smith was the first executive secretary of missions when this office was created by Synod. Otherwise, Dr. Brand was the director of foreign missions in olden days. But Synod created this new position way back in 1938. And it was he and your speaker who had traveled throughout the islands and made a survey of the field for about 7 months so that Synod can be very sure that the time, at least the opportunity to begin, was ripe or otherwise. So this is Dr. Smith. Now, we could start a little sooner, however. It so happened that way back in 1927, it's almost 48 years ago, this lady here, it's a very wealthy family, and her husband, she herself, became interested in things Philippines and decided to bring along with them a Filipino young man to their home here in St. Louis, and that's how we really got started. When she heard that we were in the States in 1951, she called up by telephone and said, I'd like to see you and your family. And so we had a visit with her in this beautiful home here on Forsyth Boulevard, the largest mansion that you see on Forsyth Boulevard here. Well, this is how we got started here in the church in the United States, way back 48 years ago. We started our work in Manila, of course, and after 3 years in Manila, the mission council at the time, or at least the missionaries who had started in Manila, said, Carino, you use your dialect and go back up north among the Ilocanos. And so it was that way back in 1949, we came to a community called Condon. At the time, it had a population of 27,000 people. We had no home there, so we had to put up a house like this with a chapel on the ground floor, which seated at the time about 100 people. And so we began our work under our apartment. Okay? And in time, of course, as our work grew here, we also started to work around and start classes and services in villages around in Condon, Lucasur. See? And later on, we had about seven churches all around the area. But that's the way mission work is often done. Start with the center and from there expand. And so we would walk along a narrow road to a barrio called Tamurong in Condon, and where our members, and seeing us pass by, began to walk also to church, so their little church which they built. Otherwise, in the beginning, missionary may start working under the coconut trees. And in time, people like this, meeting in coconut trees, realized the necessity of having a shelter over the head, and so build churches or church buildings for themselves. And so it was that we did not have to ask for a loan to build churches, but the people themselves, on realizing needs, they built their own churches. Now, a fellowship in mission work is very, very important. We ought to relate the members of the churches to each other. And so we have fellowship. We meet and have picnics once in a while And especially on Communion Sunday, our communicants, like your potluck supper, would bring their food, and there is fellowship. In the afternoon, then they would meet together and study, and they have a sort of an impromptu program among, programs among themselves. And in this way, they build up the camaraderie that should exist among them as Christians. And so congregations are then built up like that. And there was a time when we had as many as 11 stations. We had to be awake every night to serve these stations. And on Sundays, we usually had about 4 services in different places, even in the mountains, our members in the lowlands. Because of the fellowship that result, they invite us to the mountain places like this for, say, Lutheran Reformation service. We traveled scores of miles by bus, or some of them walked to the mountains, and we have then our festival in a place like Ginsadan. Now, missionaries do not close their eyes to sufferings, ignorance, superstitions, and whatever prevents them from the progress that they should enjoy. And so we try to involve friends in the community to help us in welfare work. And so we ask friends of ours, one a doctor and another one a dentist, telling them about the need in a barrio, say, Tamorong, where there are many poor people who cannot afford to be served by a doctor, or so many of them suffering from toothache and rotting teeth, but no dental services. So we would cross a river like this and go to our clinic, which our people built. And in this way, without cost to us and to the mission, we are also serving the whole man in a physical way. Our public relations are very important, and we need not isolate ourselves from the society of people in the community. These are not members of our church, but because of good public relations, they become very friendly, and when you are very friendly to them, they are more likely to feel at home when they finally come and attend church. And so the pastor's or missionary's wife can be related to the community in a civic way. So Mrs. Carino was chosen as the head of Girl Scouting at one time in the town of Candon, population 27,000. So our school teachers, one of those ladies is the wife of the governor. And so we, as missionaries, being all things to all men, would try to relate ourselves to the communities where we work. Missionary wife may have gifts of her own, and so Mrs. Carino happens to love to draw, and so she made pictures like this, posters, and in this way we had our audiovisual by hand, as it were, and in that way the children could learn more about the stories in the light of pictures that can be shown. Some of our fellow Lutherans from abroad would travel to the Philippines, and this young man, he is now a pastor in Texas, came to Manila, and he heard about our work in Candon, so he took a bus and came all the way to Candon to visit with us. We welcome visitors like that, so when you come, we have more room in our place now where to entertain you. So our people are traveling. Your missionaries, of course, have a furlough once in a while, and they come back to the United States to relate to our folks here the work that they are doing in the field. So my wife and I think Pastor Meyer was no longer in Hawaii at the time. My good friend and classmate, because Pastor Meyer and I were classmates, a classmate, Pastor Win Schrader, was pastor at the time, and he so took it that we were met in the boat by some of the members of our church in Honolulu. Again, as in Hawaii, our friends elsewhere along the way, Pastor Shibata in Tokyo and Chaplain Prenekamp heard of our coming, and so they met us in our boat. So as missionaries go around, they find fellow Christians of, and friends of kindred spirit, and they meet us. Pastor Shibata had been also in the mission field for many years in Japan. Although he grew up here in the United States, he studied in our Oakland, Concordia, finally came to the seminary here in St. Louis and became a pastor. Those are two of our girls, by the way. We have six girls, no boys. And they're all grown up. A time comes, of course, when a missionary finally takes over some of the responsibilities of leadership. So we were elected as chairman of president of the Lutheran Church in the Philippines. This was my last board of directors before I was retired from the service. Pastor Meyer talked about Rolyuda. Rolyuda is there. He's now one of our pastors. He was given a scholarship through Pastor Meyer's brother, and now he's a wonderful pastor. He's used to be an accountant, certified public accountant, but he quit his job in order to study for the holy ministry, and he's one of our outstanding mature pastors in the Philippines today. But as I said before, according to the rubrics of the mission policy, as soon as a missionary reaches 65, unless he is re-employed, may be retired. So over 2 years ago, I had to say at least I was retired from the service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as a missionary, and I was given sort of a plaque by the Lutheran Church in the Philippines. Incidentally, this is a chapel, our multi-purpose chapel that we built only about a year ago, because although we were retired, we were not retired from the service of ministering to others, and certainly in a Christian witness. So my wife and I are pretty still busy in doing the job that we had been called to do way back many years ago. And so we live in a community like this, very close by here, called San Fernando, with a population of about 60,000, a beautiful port, and also an international airport. And we are here today doing much the same kind of work, and we have beautiful environment there, beaches of all kinds, and resorts close by. And since we have no Lutheran church in this community of especially the whole province of 400,000 people, no Lutheran church at all, and since I was born in this particular region of the province of La Union, my father, who had lived here for many, many years, had a property here, and we finally repossessed the properties owned by my father close to this tree, and started our work in San Juan, a highway, one of the national highways that passed through this town of San Juan. Those trees to the right side had been planted by my father many years ago, and today it is fenced. It has a pretty good frontage of close to, almost 80 yards frontage. And here we carry out a program where we continue in terms, in the light of the mission of the church, as we find it in Holy Scriptures. The mission of the church, a mission to the whole man. And so we carry out a variety of programs here, of evangelism, for instance, of Christian nurture, education, and also human welfare. Incidentally, that house there is a tree house. There's a stairway leading into the tree house. It's supported by three tall trees, and so when you come there, you may sleep there if you wish. Can sleep about six people, at least. That's tree house. From the highway, then, you see some of our buildings. That round building there is our all-purpose or multi-purpose building where we hold all kinds of meetings. And on Sundays, we use that building for our services and Sunday school classes or Bible classes. We also put up an island in the center of a fish pond, which we dug out. And we have five kinds of fish that can be harvested from this fish pond. Just five. We have carps here, and milkfish, tilapia, catfish, and another variety of fish. It's just no equivalent in English. Anyhow, it's one way of helping the people to increase their protein intake by teaching them how to make fish buns, and in that way they can have fish anytime they want, especially when they're hungry, of course. That's the island that we have in the center of the fish pond. There are 7,107 islands in the Philippines, plus this, so it's been 7,108 islands. Well, there are many, as usual, we try to also introduce all kinds of, we have other programs, of course, as we will see from the pictures that will be flashed here quickly. For instance, agriculture. We try to experiment on different kinds of trees. The buildings that we now have in our compound, this happens to be our administration building. Formerly, I built this as a chapel, seating about 100 people. But since we have more programs to be carried out, we put up the so-called multi-purpose building, and this now is the studio in which my wife works. We have a dormitory for girls to the right. You will notice that the roofings are made of Kogan grass. That's adaptable to the kind of climate that we have in the Philippines. When it rains, it pours. And so it makes a lot of noise when it falls on a galvanized roofing. But because we have a grass roofing, it's more quiet that way. And then also, when the sun beats against the roof, it can make the house quite warm inside. Now again, the heat is absorbed by the grass roofing, and so this kind of house, as I said before, is possibly more comfortable than the conventional home built by the more affluent society. Now we also have a guest house like this. We have today a couple of American Peace Corps workers. They are now taking care of our place, and upstairs are rooms for staff members who conduct all kinds of meetings in our compound. And we also have a boys' dormitory, and we can house as many as 20 boys here, especially since we have handicapped people. The handicapped make use of the ground floor for working, and in the middle there we have a dining room. We have all kinds of meetings held in our premises, so sectional meetings may be held in smaller buildings like this. Now, since we have handicapped working there, and we have to display some of the things that they do, and so we have a display center for them. And the tourists and many other guests who come try to see what the handicapped do, and thereby help along by buying the things that they make. I said before that we have a multi-purpose building. It's pretty cheap. The roofing is made of grass, but it's adapted to the kind of climate that we have, and we can seat as many as 125, 150 people in a building like this. And this is the kind of program that we carry out. Spiritual, moral, intellectual, educational, socioeconomic, and cultural, and so on. Now, in spiritual, moral, of course, that means our evangelistic work is carried on here in our premises. And those are the baskets that the handicapped make and are sold then to those who drop in to see what they are doing. And the government is most interested in the programs that we have here in our center. That's a tree house, by the way. You can see that it's quite strong. You find the stairway along the bent trunk of a tree, and then a bridge from this tree to the tree house. It's a form of advertisement for our retreat center. Now, the main program that we carry out as retirees, of course, is spiritual. So we have services for our people here. And incidentally, there's a base, American base, close by. And this young man, a sergeant who comes from Pender, Nebraska, attends church in our chapel here. And there is a young lady who is an American field scholar in the town of San Fernando. She's a Lutheran, so she also attends services in San Juan, where we have this chapel. And we also have our weddings, of course. And so this sergeant and girlfriend, whom I have instructed to become a member of our church, were married only 2 weeks before we sailed for the United States. Now, our programs are varied. Now, we have the training of the youth, particularly out-of-school youth, leadership training. Okay? And this will then go back to their communities to help their people help themselves. And here are young people, young men and young women, willing to come here for a number of days, or at least a week, and receive some training in rural leadership. And the social workers are very much involved in this. The government is interested in programs like this. And so the social workers would meet in our premises. And of course, the missionary is involved in programs like this, such as giving a lecture and possibly also even conducting devotions for them when they meet. And other groups, such as a congregation close by, and the missionary would bring his group to our place and hold a retreat, a weekend retreat. And in this way, our people enjoy the kind of fellowship that is so desirable in a work that we are doing. The government, as I said before, is interested in the program like this. And so the social workers, they're employed by the government, would come to us and say, we would like to use your premises. Could we hold classes in here? And could you give a lecture along this line and so forth and so on? And this kind of involvement is quite common to missionaries when they establish good public relations in the community. A judge is there lecturing to these social workers held in our premises, or college students. See, they may spend a few days there and enjoy a bit of the kind of training that their leaders would carry out. They bring their guitars, they're musically inclined, they do a lot of singing. It's a part of the fellowship which they enjoy. Or writers, those are fellow Lutherans from Manila, traveling almost 150 miles in order to come and and spent a few days there to be trained on how to write literatures for our church. So we are very much involved. In other words, every day in a work like this. Now the display in what we call industrial fair, and our handicapped people show what they can do. Now these handicapped people, when making baskets, can then earn, say, their keeps. They bring their food to the center, and they sell what they weave. And in that way, they enjoy a little bit of the dignity that every human being is entitled to in this side of the world. And it's a program which the church can pretty well carry out without de-emphasizing the main thing, that's evangelism. I said before that we also experiment on agriculture. Now, I have seen lemons in Baguio City being sold for 4 pesos. That's equivalent to almost 25 cents, a lemon. Now, that's good money to anyone who can raise lemons like this. So I planted the seeds like this. I of course planted the seeds in soil, and then transferred the plant later on, transplanted it. And lo and behold, after 2 years, these trees began to bear flowers. And so here we have a lemon tree. Now, supposing you have 100 lemon trees like that, and here you may find as many as 30, 35 lemons on one tree. It's quite an income for the people who do not have visible incomes. So in this way, our visitors would come and are amazed by this kind of a tree. They usually ask, can you give us seeds? Can you give us seedlings? And so I have a seedling bed, and whenever somebody asks for a seedling, I would give seedling free. And that's quite contributive to the welfare of many people who don't know any better. Otherwise, our place is sort of an oasis for our fellow Christians, members of our church, and others. So they drop in on us, and they break bread with us. And my wife has lots of friends also in the barrios. That old lady there is about 90 years old, and they're very friendly. And folks in the neighborhood, this sergeant at Wallace and others would come to our place. They feel at home, and some of them, as I said before, are fellow Lutherans. And here's our fellow Lutheran sergeant who worship with us in our chapel in San Juan, and others like this AFS scholar. So we continue, even if we are now retired, we are not retired from serving our Lord. And we even went as far as putting up a sort of a beach house there for our guests, so that when they come and hold seminars and workshops, and they're tired of staying in the compound, they would go to our beach house there and enjoy the very cool sea breezes. And incidentally, this town of San Juan, where we live, is getting to be developed as a tourist center. That's a new restaurant out there being built. And next to it is a former Muslim tower. There's a story about towers like this. The Mohammedans, you know, were slavers at one time, and they would come to the north in our town of San Juan and kidnap boys and girls and sold them into slavery, particularly the Portuguese slavers. And some of them have found themselves in New Orleans, here in America. They were sold there as slaves when the emancipation of slaves took place in America. Some of these Filipino slaves in New Orleans established what we call a Manila Village in New Orleans, believe it or not. So there had been slaves from the Philippines sold to America long ago. But that explains the Moro Tower. And Our little beach house is quite comfortable. It can accommodate so many young folks there. We have a well there. We dug a well there for them. And so we planted trees close to the beach, close to the water, so that in time we will have coconut trees here for a shade. And the youth of the land, of course, in any country, are often known as the hope of tomorrow. And so our Philippine government encourages the education of the young. Today, there are about at least 3 million boys and girls studying in our secondary schools alone. And incidentally, we have at least 65% of the people in the Philippines are young people from 18 years old down. 65%, can you imagine that? That's a country of young people, of youth. And so that's the hope of, as Rizal called them, the youth, the hope of the fatherland. Well, we would like to end our presentation by reminding you that there in the Philippines, your church is trying to carry out its mission as best as it can. Unfortunately, the specter of communism has been hanging on the people of Asia. And here, notice the progress of communism. Most of Asia is under communist control today. See? With Southeast Asia now under communism, what is left today? The danger that human freedom will be lost. The Philippines is a sort of an oasis of freedom that people who are free can still come to this country. And we have a country that seems to have a mission. And with Christianity being the majority religion here in the island, in the Philippines, there's hope that your church and mine can train workers here and send them out to the 2.5 billion people who live in Asia, 92% of whom, I would rather, only 2% of whom are committed to Christianity. As we see the rainbow here in the Philippines, we say there is hope. God has given a promise that he would not destroy a people. See, he wants a people to come to the knowledge of the truth and be saved. Well, thank you very much.